All right.
Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. And welcome to Make Me Smart, the show all about tech, the economy, culture, deep dramatic size.
Well, I mean, I don't have any other kinds of size.
If there was ever a week for it. And you guys, thank goodness, help us get smart every week because, as we like to say, none of us is as smart as all of us.
So here is what we are going to do today. We've been doing an on-and-off thing the past couple of months about the economics of inequality in this society and in this economy, because there's lots of it. Wages, wealth gap, the whole deal. Today, we're going to look at inequality as it breaks down in this country along racial lines, because it is enormous, it is growing, and it is hugely impactful for wherever we're going in this economy, honestly, is the deal.
Yeah. And we know that this is not a new conversation. We are now starting to hear from a new wave of politicians who are speaking a lot more candidly about race and inequality than ever before. And we are not going to talk about the politics, we hope. We're not going to talk about those candidates, is what I mean. But we do want to continue this conversation because it is, of course, hugely important to the future of this country and the people who live here.
So here's what we're going to do. We're actually going to Molly and I can talk tech and the economy till the cows come home. We are going to get an expert on the phone. We have gotten her on the phone. Her name is Valerie Wilson. She's the director of the program on race, ethnicity, and the economy at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. And she is here to basically hook us up. Valerie, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This idea of racism and the economic inequality that results from the structural racism in this economy, that's a whole set of people's lived experiences every single day, whether they're black, of color, take your pick. And then there's a whole section of this economy and society whose lived experience it is not, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And that's just, that makes the conversation just that much harder.
It can make it harder, especially when we use race as a way to be divisive.
Yeah.
And to sort of, you know, pit one community, one race, one group of people against another. But I think when we look at the economic issues, they're very similar. You know, everybody wants the same thing, right? Everybody wants to be able to have a decent job, to earn a decent living, to be able to provide for their families, to enjoy some of their life. You know, you don't have to work constantly to be able to just have a level of basic sustenance. But I think, you know, we all face challenges to how we do that. Now, those challenges vary based on our race or ethnicity or gender, again, because of how things structurally have been developed and put in place in this country. But the goals, the objectives, the fact that we all face challenges to meeting those economic objectives is something that's really universal. And I think that would be a much more constructive conversation than some of the conversation that leads to scapegoating and a lot of the division.
Yeah, I often wonder if it's a little bloodless or a cop-out to sort of say, to put this conversation in purely economic terms. But at the same time, it feels absurd, increasingly absurd, to talk about growth in America and global growth and economic success without acknowledging how many people could be contributing at a much higher level to growth and economic success by having their own individual success.
Right, right. I mean, all these things are interconnected. You know, I talk a lot about, you know, how there's intersections between class and race and gender, and that, you know, nobody experiences inequality on a single front. So, you know, a lot of these issues do intersect, even though, you know, your specific situation or circumstance may be very specific or individual. Again, the experience of inequality, especially at this point, is very broad. You know, we talk about the fact that inequality has grown significantly, even over the last 40 or 50 years. And the way that it's grown has put really the folks at the very top, the top 1%, top 0.1%, however far up you want to go, has really demonstrated that group has really pulled out away from everybody else. And so I think, you know, the whole issue of growing inequality can be something that's used to sort of bring people together to rethink how we think our economy should work and how the benefits of what workers produce on their jobs daily should be more equitably distributed and shared across all who are engaged in that.
I'm going to talk about the President of the United States and this thing he says all the time about black unemployment in this economy and how it's the lowest it's ever been. And he rides those waves in his speeches and every time the jobs numbers come out. What are we to make of that?
So, you know, on one hand, it is true. The black unemployment rate is the lowest that it has been since the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been gathering that data. But I think what is missing in that conversation is the fact that that black unemployment rate is still double the white unemployment rate, currently at 6%. I think when we look at it in the broader context of the overall national unemployment rate being about 3.7% now, 6% isn't really something to be boasting about unless there's sort of a normalization of that inequality in the labor market, whereby African Americans are twice as likely to be unemployed than white Americans, even when we're talking about people with similar skills and educational backgrounds.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And then in addition to double the unemployment numbers of white Americans, you look at census data and black Americans come in behind not only whites, but Asians, Caucasians, Latinos, with a median household income of around $40,000 a year. Why isn't there, and how, you know, there just isn't that mobility on top of that, right?
Well, I think all of these things are layered. So when we talk about disparities in employment outcomes, the majority of households in this country get income because they work through a job. So if you're less likely to be employed, that's already a hit against your income. The other factor is that when you are employed, we still have significant disparities in pay on the basis of race and gender. Again, that filters into income disparities. And then those income disparities filter into so many other areas of life. If we were talking about the home ownership gap, if we were talking about differences in, based on where people live, what kinds of schools their children have access to. And then on top of that is the wealth gap that sort of overlays all of these issues in terms of economic vulnerability and sustainability.
Has it not, and I ask this not facetiously at all, but our, since, you know, there's it's in the news this year that we are now 400 years since slavery was introduced on this continent. Has it not always been thus that African Americans and people of color in this economy have suffered? And the following question then is, what's the cure?
Yeah, that's a loaded question. Right?
I know. And look, let's go there too, right? Because there's lots of people talking about that.
Yeah. So that has always been the case. And I think it's very clear when we talk about the fact that it has always been the case, that we're clear on why it has been the case, that that has been a very intentional and structural sort of issue whereby race was, you know, introduced as a way to decide who would have access to wealth and opportunity and who wouldn't. And so the fact that our country was founded on that and, you know, we still see these gaps today tells you that, you know, just how durable that inequality is. And the fact is, it doesn't go anywhere unless we decide, just like we intentionally decided to institute laws and policies that would create those inequalities, unless we decide to institute policies and practices that would eliminate those, they don't go away.
You're quoted in a story about this recent report from the Cleveland Fed that talks about how there is a possibility that all of those historical factors could be improved simply by closing the labor and income gap. That if everybody got paid the same, that would at least make a dent in the black-white wealth gap. And you're quoted somewhat skeptically in response to that, but I would love to get your thoughts.
So, I mean, I think that would be a huge step if we were able to close the wage gap and people were paid equitably and fairly when they are doing the same job and producing the same output. But I am a bit skeptical that that's going to completely resolve the wealth gap, because inequality is written into policies across our economy. It's not just a matter of differences in pay on a job. It has to do with when people go to get loans, whether or not they are able to get the loan, and then what interest rate they get on that loan. It has to do with the history of redlining in this country and laws that determined where African Americans could live, and the fact that those communities that had a higher percentage of African American residences, the homes in those communities would not appreciate at the same rate as homes in communities where there are that are predominantly white. So closing the wage gap alone, like I said, goes a long way to addressing income disparities. But I'm very skeptical that that's going to eliminate a wealth gap, because it is such a pervasive issue in our economy. It's if it could be fixed by that, I would think, you know, someone would have made a lot of progress in doing that.
That'd
by
be great.
Now. Yep. And in fact, the current wage gap is larger than it has been historically.
Right.
And, you know, we don't see that, you know, at that time when we had a smaller black-white wage gap. So, for example, in 1979, the difference in pay between blacks and whites was about 9%. It wasn't necessarily the case then that the wealth gap was that much smaller, so that it's not solely connected to differences in pay.
So, well, keep going. Riff on that for a little while. What are the remedies?
So,
I know I'm asking a really complicated question in a simplistic form. I appreciate that.
So I think the remedy depends in large part on what it is we're trying to address. You know, I can talk about policies that can address pay disparities, and that, you know, will go a long way in that area, but it is not necessarily going to eliminate disparities in other parts of our economy. And I think we also have to continue to maintain sight of history. You know, we like to think that if something gets further removed from us in terms of years, that it's no longer relevant or it no longer plays a role. And research has shown time and time again that what we see today is absolutely a reflection of history and policies that have put in place that established structures of inequality that continue to perpetuate themselves unless we deliberately do something to undo that or disentangle that. I know one of the topics that comes up a lot now in political discussion is the issue of reparations. And you know, I'm not here to debate that issue. I think, though, that is something that's critical when we're talking about how we really address these problems head on. Again, I talked about how history plays a role in the unequal distribution of income and wealth. If we really want to address that problem, then we are going to have to redistribute some things if we really want to address those gaps.
So two things. One is, I want to give a shout out to our episode a couple of weeks ago about how important history is. Hello, says the history major. I'd just like to point that out. Number two, though, do you think we're having, you know, for all of the attempts at having a national conversation about this that get sidetracked by one thing or another, and we all know what those are, do you think we're actually having a serious discussion about that in this country, or are we just kind of paying it lip service?
I think, in my opinion, at this point, it's a little hard to tell whether it's a serious discussion or not. Yeah. I think it's more of a discussion than we have had in a long time. So that in and of itself, the fact that people are willing to stand on a debate stage before a national audience and talk about it indicates that, you know, there's room at least to start a discussion. How far that goes, I don't know. These conversations often get sidetracked with the idea in question of, if you're going to bring it up, you have to explain the complete package, the complete way to do it right up front. I think that's counterproductive.
How are you
going to pay for it? Right.
Right. Right. I think that's counterproductive. I think we're at we have to start at the place of saying why it's justified, why we should even start to have a conversation about this. And then we can move beyond that to talk about ways that we get it done. And again, I think, you know, we're kind of near that starting point now by the fact that so many people have raised the issue. But I think there's still a long way to go to really get into thinking about why we should do it and how we should do it and when we should do it.
Yeah.
I know that I am literally the person who said that we weren't going to talk about the politics of it. However, that was a lie. Is it harder? I mean, on the one hand, you know, we had somebody on who, Sam Sanders, I think, said, look, I did not think in my lifetime that a Democratic, you know, candidate for president would stand up on a stage, like you just said, Valerie, and use the word reparation and talk about that redistributive effort. But at the same time, I think we are increasingly seeing race become a partisan issue. And I wonder if for every step we make forward with those candidates on those stages, are we also taking steps back?
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the challenges that we have had in this country for a long time. I think both parties talk about race. We just talk about it in very different ways. And I don't think that we really are honest with ourselves about those differences and how mm-hmm. race gets discussed. Mm-hmm. On one hand, we can have, you know, a Democratic debate and people are talking about the reasons why we should have reparations and acknowledging the fact that there is racism in this country and racial inequality that plays out in so many of the social and economic outcomes that are important to well-being in this country. And then on the other side, you know, we can have hate speech and hate rallies that are also about race, but not in a very constructive way. So the challenge is, you know, getting everyone to really have the same conversation about the same thing and, you know, be on the same topic. I don't think it's that both parties don't discuss race. I think that the way that it's discussed is very distinct.
So if we assume positive intent by all the parties in this conversation, which is, as you said, a countless number of intersections, just as a way to sort of play this forward and let you get on with what else you have to do today. So I noted that it's been 400 years since slavery was introduced on this continent. Do you think it's going to take us another 400 years to figure this out?
Oh, man.
I would hope it doesn't take another 400 years. At the same time, it's not going to happen overnight. Yeah. It won't happen in this election cycle or the next or the one after that, probably. But, you know, we just have to continue to keep these issues, you know, at the forefront of our public debate, of our household conversations, and really be honest about, you know, the America we live in versus the dream or the ideal that we like to portray.
Valerie Wilson at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, Director of the Program on Race, Ethnicity, and the Economy. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks.
Thanks, Valerie.
Thanks, Molly.
Well, I don't think that was an untoward question, by the way, the whole 400 years thing.
It was not untoward at all. Okay. It was just depressing.
All right. Yes. All right. Well, that's my job.
To even contemplate.
That's my job in this podcast.
That is your thing. I know. And, you know, we have to face that reality because of the two steps forward, two steps back situation.
Yeah, or three steps back. Anyway.
Or three steps back, yes. So
that, we went like, what, 15 minutes with Valerie, and obviously we could have gone 15 hours because there's so much. Send us your thoughts on that entire conversation, and we'll get a handful of them, honestly, on the podcast in the next couple of weeks. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Send us a voicemail. Let us know what you think.
Yep, we're going to take a quick break. We will be back with our fixations, which are not going to be a lot cheerier. See you in a minute.
Nice. Way to set that one up.
Welcome back to the show. It's time to fixate. It's going to be great. It's going to be so
All right.
interesting and uplifting. My fixation is we rate dogs on Twitter. It's just cute. No, I'm just kidding. That's not what it is.
I don't even know what
it is.
Okay,
but if you need a minute,
a good one though.
We it's a good one. If you need, if you just need to add a one fun,
yes,
to your list, to your Twitter list.
One though, only one. All right. So enough of dogs and the fun that they are. What do you want to do? You want to start or what?
Nope. You go ahead.
Am I going to go ahead? Okay. So listen, this is actually me offloading my responsibilities in this segment onto you. There were the shootings this past weekend. As far as we know, only the one in El Paso has been directly connected to race and ethnicity and that intent on the part of the shooter, right? So we're leaving the Dayton shooting out of this. But what has happened as a result is that, as we know, the shooter's manifesto was posted onto a site called 8chan, moments before the shooting, like 20 minutes before the shooting. It was a racist screed. It was all kinds of horrible things. As a result of that, a company named Cloudflare has taken this site called 8chan, in essence, out of its has denied its service, and mm-hmm. that had the effect of briefly taking 8chan off the internet. 8chan has since been taken off the internet by another company. But here's what I want to do: I want you to tell me, first of all, what Cloudflare does, why it has the power to take companies off the internet. It did so with the Daily Stormer a couple of 3 years ago. So tell me what Cloudflare is, and then let's have that speech debate.
Yeah, okay.
sorry to chuckle.
Cloudflare. I know, totally. I'm trying to come up with a way to explain this that will be comprehensible.
Yeah. Shorter's better. Let me just say shorter's better.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All
right. It's there. If 8chan is the house, then Cloudflare is the municipality. It runs the power lines to the house. It provides the police that keep, you know, ideally mm-hmm. the house from being burglarized. So what it really does is provide this infrastructure support. It makes sure that the content from the websites on its network is delivered.
Okay.
And then it also protects them from hacking.
Got it.
And so if they take that away, then this site is kind of like not part of the city, right?
Got it. Okay. All right. That's fair. So Cloudflare has decided
so it loses
that it's,
this right. protection.
So in effect, it has tossed 8chan sort of outside city walls, as it were. And the CEO of Cloudflare, Matthew Prince, who we had on the Marketplace 3 or 4 years ago when they took the Daily Stormer out, right, where they denied its service. We had a conversation about how he feels about being the guy, one dude, man, running a company, taking somebody offline. Yeah. Here we are now, 3 years later, horrible incidents have occurred. There is a very vibrant debate now about free speech in the internet and hate speech that was not around 3 years ago. Discuss.
And we should say that 8chan's removal from the city walls was itself sort of dramatic because at first... Cloudflare CEO said, I don't think we should take it down. It's obviously problematic, but I'm nervous about, you know, sort of making this decision. And I don't necessarily believe that it will do any good because 8chan will just pop up somewhere else.
Right.
And then reversed course within hours and removed the infrastructure from 8chan. And so you could see almost the free speech conversation play out in his own mind.
How do you feel about that, right? I mean, you and I have had this conversation many a time about Twitter and Facebook and, you know, all of that.
We have. I mean, and I have, and it's not helpful because I think in some cases I've come out on both sides of this debate.
Well, look, it's a complicated thing, man, right?
Because it is a complicated thing. I think that what I will say is from a legal perspective, these sites have no obligation. They have no First Amendment obligation to keep these conversations alive. They're private companies. And as we discussed recently on our show about Section 230, which is the law that gives protection to platforms based on what their users post online. It says they can't be sued if people post lawful content online. The evolution of that law made it a precedent that the sites won't get in trouble even if they meddle with the content,
right?
They won't be held liable even if they exercise some control over the content. There was a lawsuit that established that as precedent. So they are legally protected in both regards, First Amendment and in terms of losing mm-hmm. any immunity from prosecution based on what users post. So they actually don't have any more excuses for not dealing with something that we now know based on science and research, right, is mm-hmm. radicalizing people. Like, these are effectively, for all intents and purposes, and we saw the outcome of that this weekend, some of these chat rooms and forums are effectively terrorist networks. And it is incumbent probably on law enforcement. We actually had a conversation on today's episode of Marketplace Tech with a cybersecurity expert.
Right.
Who said, look, there's a real difference in the way that we address international terrorism, the jihadi kind, and domestic terrorism, usually the white supremacy kind, with respect to the law. Like, there are limits that these platforms can run up against if it's giving aid and comfort to international terrorism or assisting or abetting. And the and law enforcement in America, the FBI, is only now starting to make a connection between conspiracy theories and extremist content and real world violence.
So let me squeeze you a little bit here, right? You ready?
Yeah.
Do you think you did the right thing, taking HN off?
I do. Oh, absolutely. I do. Because there's also research, like counterterrorism experts will tell you that disrupting terrorist networks does make a difference, even if it's in the short term. And the Daily Stormer may still be up, but it is really hard to find. Like you got to work a lot harder. And when you look at the sort of performative part of this, which is about getting up where these shooters and these young extremists want a lot of attention and they want to be seen, the less seen they are, the less power that network has in some ways. Mm-hmm. It's not to say people won't still be radicalized or find this, but making it accessible to fewer people like inevitably reduces the chance of real world violence.
Okay. All right. So that's my Cloudflare HN thing. And thank you for doing all the heavy lifting and letting me just ask questions. Okay, your turn.
mine is no less difficult, which is that I have really found myself worried about the conversation about mental illness with respect to these shootings. And I just wanted to point to a story today about the country's largest organization of psychiatrists saying it is dangerous, the American Psychiatric Association, it is dangerous to link gun violence with mental illness because you risk stigmatizing, you risk trampling on their civil rights. And we have reached actually a point where mental illness is less stigmatized than it has been. People are comfortable talking about depression.
And it's been a long haul getting there.
And it's been a really long haul getting there. And in fact, there is no evidence that mental illness is to blame for mass shootings. And I worry that we will demonize a group of very, very vulnerable people if this is the rhetoric that gets attached.
Amen. I totally agree. Totally agree. There you go.
See, I told you we were going to keep it simple in the news fix.
Okay.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Yeah, buddy.
Definitely. Last week, we got smart about TikTok. I can tell you that this week I have spent a lot of time watching those people
have
at the
you?
British farm
oh,
and the critters.
Yeah, I tried it. It was me.
I just watched the critters. I love it.
Okay.
Because I can't take much more. Anyway, listener Tim Funk has never used TikTok, but did listen to the show, and he had this follow-up question.
In the TikTok discussion, it felt like there was something missing, YouTube. If TikTok eliminates the 15-second limit, how is it any different than YouTube? Both allow for followers, and they both use AI to keep you addicted to related content. Please make me smart.
Over to you, boss lady.
Oh, I mean, it's competition to YouTube. For one thing, it's mobile first, right? It's YouTube is like people still watch it on their computer. They use it in place of TV and all of that. And there's no sign that TikTok will eliminate the 15-second limit. So it is sort of a different medium in that way. Look, will it eventually become like a thing that people watch all the time and they use AI to keep you addicted to related content? Sure. We should make it clear that it's always that it was in the same it's competition to Facebook and it's competition to YouTube for sure. Yes, that is true.
There we go. I still don't quite. I mean, I flipped through it, but you know what? It's not for me anyway. So the other thing we talked about was Facebook and their Libra launch. This is their crypto payment system and currency and, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's next attempt to take over the world. And we talked about how Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO of Facebook, sometimes exerts undue influence in that company. And maybe that's what was going on here. Here's what Joe Selby said.
I think one of the reasons that folks in that situation find themselves unable to question the vision or judgment of the founder or leader in that situation is that, frankly, most businesses don't have anything remotely like that going on. There's a dearth of even basic leadership in most organizations, so when someone, particularly a young adult, encounters a founder or executive who does have a vision they can articulate clearly, it's beyond compelling and very easy to be pulled out to shore by it.
I mean, maybe, but I think he's selling leadership at every level of business in this economy a little bit short there, Joe. That's what I think you're doing.
Is he?
I think
I'm obsessed. Have you heard about this book called It's the Manager?
No.
The Gallup book?
No.
So Gallup did this survey and essentially, and they did this huge, I know, right? As they do. I know that was a little Captain Obvious moment. In shocking news, Gallup conducted a survey. Yeah. They did this huge study on the future of work. And they basically found that the single strongest factor in a company's success or failure is managers at every level. And they basically were like, P.S., all the managers in America are terrible. Yeah, and then they put out a whole book about it, and I'm dying to read it. It was fascinating.
All right.
I mean, and I like, is Silicon Valley staffed with, like, a ton of people under 35 who are in jobs that might have actually just been invented 6 hours ago? And the entire company is structured around the thoughts and ideas and vision of one person. Like, yes. I mean, of course that was going to happen. But also,
putting the link to that book,
apparently
right
the managers are kind of terrible.
All right,
I did. I put it in because it's like a
browse it.
Little,
how about that?
I'm excited to read this. I'm like weirdly obsessed with it. All right. Kai fixated on Senator Hawley's Social Media Addiction Reduction Technology Act.
Smart act. Yeah, buddy.
I mentioned how I hate Netflix's addictive UI. I was like, help me, Josh Hawley. Sign me up. Which immediately takes you to the next episode of a show without showing you the credits. Listener Jen posted on Twitter about this. Wait, you like that it doesn't show you the credits?
Yeah. I mean, look, apologies to the third grip and the best boy and the gaffer and all that, but can I get content, please?
What about the guest voices?
Now I'm getting hate mail. There's hate mail coming to me on this one.
Voices? From a gaffer. Jen said,
which hopefully will explain exactly what a gaffer does. But anyway, go ahead.
I don't know, but I have the tape. She says,
that was so good.
Right? Gaffer tape. That stuff is the best. She says she agrees with me. She also hates the autoplay of the show or movie trailer and the skipping of the end credits. And a lot of people complained about how it starts like just playing you a preview of a thing that you're not watching. And maybe you really like the theme song and you want to listen to that.
Yes.
I hate that. And then another Twitter listener, and I failed to capture it, and I'm sorry. And then it was like gone in my mentions, sent me a fix. And we'll have it in the show notes because you can turn it off. You can turn off the autoplay if you are like me, or you can keep it on if you're like Kai.
There you
and
go.
And everybody wins.
And you will be judged accordingly. Let me just say. let me just say. All right.
Tell us at your own peril.
That's right. That's right. Because we will definitely judge you. Okay. The Make Me Smart answer, the question to which is, of course, what is something you thought you knew but you later found out about? Stephanie Lampkin is the founder and CEO of Blendor. It's a recruiting app that tries to diversify workplaces by breaking down unconscious bias in the hiring process. Here's what she said.
I thought that I was very risk-averse, practical, stay on the straight and narrow, until I got into entrepreneurship and realized, like, what I'm doing is really crazy and insane and it makes no sense. And anyone practical or you know, not crazy would never pursue this path. But I'm sort of... I've been like reaching into the depths of something, I don't know, ancestral that's like really kept me going despite just how insane and impractical this path is. I'm in this space of building technology to mitigate bias, right? And bias is sort of a rebranding of racism and sexism. And so I think about all of the people before me who had it way harder trying to combat this problem. And now I'm sort of in this position living in Silicon Valley, trying to solve it with technology. I think I'm drawing from the efforts and energy and spiritual connection that I have with all the Black women and men in our country who have tried to solve a lot of the same problems that we're experiencing today.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. When you, I have such admiration for entrepreneurs, just full stop, because the chutzpah that it takes, right? The risk tolerance and all of that. Yeah, God bless them.
Yeah,
truly.
I know, and I don't want to be a techno chauvinist, but at the same time, like what to our earlier points, whatever it takes, every piece of the puzzle should be tried.
Yep.
And go, Stephanie.
Yeah.
That question again, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Email us your answers. Make a voice recording. We love it. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. Or frankly, if you're interesting and cool enough, Shara Morris will come to you like she does.
Wow.
She will come and find you.
Full service podcast.
And please remember, she just does it. Please remember to subscribe to the Make Me Smart newsletter. Go to marketplace.org/newsletters for fun facts and cool photos and just neat things to learn about.
Staff recommendations, all kinds of cool stuff. Listener recommendations, actually. So it's actually really good. Totally proud of that one. All right. That's three deep sighs in this podcast. I don't even know what I'm doing.
I know.
Have I mentioned that I've got really big lungs, by the way? Have we had that conversation?
Yeah, okay, we talked about your lungs.
Never mind. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. Senior producer is Eve Tro. Never mind. It's a long story about tuberculosis. Senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore. Ben's back from vacation, so he's actually working this week. I'm just saying.
Good job, Ben.
You know.
I love how, like, all the little nuggets that Kai drops as asides are, like, a whole chapter in the book. Tuberculosis, eh? This week's program was engineered by Drew Dostad. Thank you also to Christian Buckler in our DC bureau, which is where Valerie was. Our theme music was composed by Bent Holliday and Daniel Ramirez. It's Not Long Enough. The executive director of On Demand is Taryn Yevis, and senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Oh, nicely done. Trained podcast professional right there.
I am pretty proud of that.
Applause on the other end of the line.
I'm clapping for myself. If I don't, no one will, people.
That's right. That's right. Oh, man. All right. There we go. Another one in the can, peeps.